We have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomczyk with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No job this morning?
No job. He's on a trip.
He's getting some vacation time in.
Yep.
All right. Well, still plenty to cover, starting with local, and it looks like we finally have an idea what initiatives are going to be on the ballot.
Yeah, yesterday was the day when initiative backers had to turn in their signatures in order to qualify initiatives for the ballot in November. And three initiatives look like they have plenty of signatures to qualify. One of those, I-1183, is the liquor privatization initiative, the one that's often called the Costco initiative, because Costco is the company that has put a lot of money into the campaign for I-1183 so far. It would close state liquor stores and the liquor distribution center, and it would allow private stores to sell alcohol, but only as long as they have at least 10,000 square feet of retail space. And that's interesting because a lot of the folks who are for liquor privatization use the argument of, well, you go to the state liquor store and there's not enough selection. Wouldn't it be great if I could go down the street to the little specialty store that carries all, for example, all of the flavored vodkas that are produced in the United States? Well, that's not what's going to happen because those little specialty stores won't exist if this liquor privatization initiative passes. It's going to be big box stores, and you know that big box stores are not going to carry the little craft products produced by small distributors and small producers in the United States. They won't be able to make the margin on those. They make a margin on the products that they can buy in bulk and sell for relatively cheaply. So basically what you're going to get is more of the kinds of stores we already have through the state distribution system, just with a larger quantity of the same crappy booze.
And the bigger the store is, the further spread out they are as well.
Yes, exactly. And in addition, nobody has really studied how much this would change the amount of revenue that the state takes in from how much they would take in under the new initiative versus what they take in now through the state distribution system. So it's really unknown territory, although I'm sure that analysis or competing analyses of the initiative will come out during the initiative campaign. So it looks so far like that one will qualify for the ballot. In addition, I-1163 will probably also qualify. That one would require background checks and training for long-term care workers and providers. This is basically something that voters already passed in 2008. This is putting it before the voters again because the state legislature hasn't funded the program. This would essentially force the state legislature to put it into, hopefully force them to put it into practice. Push the state legislature to fund it so that it actually becomes law. I think just about everybody would support I-1163. I mean, all you have to do is think about not wanting to have a pedophile or not wanting to have a sexual predator taking care of grandma while you go out to buy groceries. I mean, who's gonna be against I-1163? But once again, we have to vote on it a second time in order to get politicians to do something about it. The third initiative that looks like it will qualify for the ballot is I-1125. That's the Tim Iman initiative. And it would require the state legislature to set tolls on highway projects instead of a state transportation commission appointed by the governor. In addition, it would prohibit variable tolling on highway projects, so it would specify that the legislature would have to set a flat rate so that you would pay the same amount in tolls regardless of when you would travel on a given highway or freeway bridge or in the case of the downtown traffic tunnel, whenever you go through the tunnel, you would pay the same rate at all times. The I-1125 would also require that all toll, and this is the most controversial part of it, that all tolls collected on a highway project be used only for maintenance of that highway project itself. So you couldn't collect tolls on I-90 and use them to pay for construction of the new 520 floating bridge. And there's been some analysis in the news about how I-1125 would impact the downtown traffic tunnel, saying that, oh gosh, you know, the fact that you have to charge flat rate tolls you know, the same rate all the time would really negatively impact the funding for the downtown traffic tunnel. But that was not the intent of Tim Iman or the backers of the initiative. The main backer of the initiative, who's provided the bulk of the funding, just for example, the amount raised for I-1125 so far has been about $681,000. Most of it, a total of $500,000, has been donated by Eastside developer Kemper Freeman Jr. And the reason he supports it is because the state is proposing charging tolls on I-90 and 520 in order to support the total cost of not just building the replacement for 520, but also putting light rail transit on the 520 bridge. Kemper Freeman wants to stop light rail from going to the east side. He's very much against all forms of transit, in particular the east side light rail expansion. So that's really what the intent of this initiative would do. It's an anti-transit initiative, and it would make it extremely difficult for any of the money collected in tolls on a highway project to be spent for anything but automobile use. So that's going to qualify for the ballot as well. There are two initiatives that won't be on the ballot. One is the initiative to legalize marijuana. It fell short of the number of signatures required to put it on the ballot, unfortunately. And Initiative 1130, which would have banned battery cages for chickens in the state of Washington, that was withdrawn by initiative backers because of a national agreement between the Humane Society of the U.S. and the United Egg Producers. They agreed this week that they would work on federal legislation that would replace this initiative, which really proves that these local movements to put initiatives on the state ballot and pass state laws that the federal government is not working on can have a national impact. On the other hand, they may have initiative backers may have withdrawn I-1130 a little bit early because just a verbal agreement between the Humane Society and the Egg Producers Association that they're going to work on drafting federal legislation doesn't necessarily mean that legislation is going to be introduced or that it's going to go forward. So I'm a little disappointed to see that even though I-1130 got plenty of signatures to qualify for the ballot, that initiative backers decided to pull it. I think that might have been a mistake.
All right. Moving on, Mayor McGinn this week coming out with a jobs package proposal.
Yeah, Mayor Mike McGinn announced this week that he had a jobs package to revive the local construction industry. He estimated that it would create some 2,400 jobs, and his package doesn't involve any funding from the city. It just involves getting rid of some old rules on the books. So that raised my antenna a little bit whenever I hear that the city is streamlining requirements for developers. I had to take a peek at that. What I noticed an initial peek sort of showed me that most of these really are old rules that really are not applicable, particularly if you want to increase density in the city. The best news of all is that it would relax parking requirements for new construction in dense urban areas. So we would see these large buildings would not be excavating, you know, huge holes in the ground in order to put in lots and lots and lots of levels of parking, and you wouldn't see as many above ground parking garages. That's pretty good news, I think. On the other hand, it's good news if there's a lot of transit available, and that's another thing we want to talk about this week too, is proposed cuts at Metro. The King County executive Dow Constantine released a list of proposed cuts for Metro bus service in 2012. The first round of cuts would hit in February 2012, but if the county council doesn't pass the $20 car tab fee for transit, or if they don't put it on the November ballot, then the cuts would not just be in February of 2012. There would be further cuts. The first round of cuts They would have to cut about 100,000 hours in February, but over the next 2 years, they'd have to cut a total of 600,000 hours of bus service. That's a total of about 17% of that. Well, the first 100,000 hours, I understand, is about 17% of the bus service that's out there. 600,000 would completely decimate the system. And if you look at the, list of routes that they're proposing to eliminate, under the proposal to cut 600,000 hours of bus service, they would totally eliminate routes like the number four route. They would almost completely eliminate the number two route. These are routes that go to Lower Queen Anne, some of the first and most important routes in the city. They would eliminate the number 26 route, for example. That's the bus I take every Saturday morning to get to the radio show. And by not having that route available to me, I would have to get up at least a half hour earlier. It would take me more than an hour to get here on Saturday mornings. They'd eliminate, for example, the bus route 25, the 28, the 42, the 46, the 67, which is used by University of Washington students to get to class. The number 72 and 73 routes, which are almost always packed with mm-hmm. people standing in the aisles to get to the university district. It would eliminate all of the night owl routes, the 81, 82, 83, 84, and 85. I mean, these are major cuts. It would also eliminate a lot of routes going to the south end and to the east side as well. And then almost every other route that would be left over would see reductions in service. So that is, I think, just... another route that they would eliminate, too, is the route number 43. Who in the city of Seattle has not ridden the number 43 route? If you take that one away, it's like, to me, it just seems like who is talking about these cuts, you know, and who's yeah. making these decisions? It's they're talking about some pretty major cuts. So it's just appalling to me to see this level of cuts in bus service. Very unfair to the people who don't have cars, can't afford to drive in the city where parking is becoming increasingly more expensive and less available, and where at a time when gas prices are high, people can't necessarily afford to drive anymore. Demand is increasing for Metro Transit services, and to see these kind of cuts proposed, and to see county council members saying, we can't raise taxes, we can't ask drivers to chip in, you know, an extra $20 a year, you know, when users of the Metro Transit system, bus riders, have taken increases in fares for the last 2 to 3 years running, and will probably see further fare increases. We are paying, you know, Metro Transit riders are already paying increased fares. Pass prices are becoming extremely high. You know, it is time for other folks to chip in as well.
Yeah, just calling them cuts doesn't really seem appropriate. It's closer to like dismemberment.
Dismemberment, exactly. Yeah, and already with the cuts that we've seen in the last year or two at Metro Transit, the bus system is running at full capacity right now. It's often... you try to get on a bus and it's jam-packed and there's no room for you. And Metro buses routinely run 10 or more minutes late. So already the system is strained and is near to breaking point. With these kind of cuts, then it'll be a question of whether we even have bus service anymore.
All right. Well, still plenty to cover. Let's move on. The Seattle Ward Dollars Resolution.
Yeah, Nick Licata introduced a resolution to the city council this week calling on the president to end the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and to redirect war spending to domestic priorities, a big issue given that cities and states all over the United States have had to cut their budgets pretty severely because of the lack of federal funding for some programs that the state and cities have to step in and take over. The full council will vote on this resolution on Monday at their 2 p.m. meeting at City Hall at 5th and Cherry. So I'm urging people to go down. And if you've never sat in on a city council meeting, you ought to. It's very educational, and this is a good time to do it.
And it's your City Hall.
It is your City Hall.
And it's quite nice, the new one.
It is.
So you should enjoy some of the
nicer
comfy chairs.
Yeah, nicer than a lot of places where people live these days.
All right, moving on. This week's SPD update.
Yeah, another Seattle police officer was charged with assault this week, this time for stomping on the head of a man who was handcuffed and lying on the ground. And if you go to the Seattle Times website, you can see the dash cam video that caught the officer doing just that. He was actually not on the job when he did this. He was at a bar with a friend and decided to play police, you know, at the bar. And he pulled out his badge, and the guys he flashed it to didn't believe it was real, and he got into an altercation. And Seattle police were called to come and break up the altercation, of which he was one of the two fighting parties. And the police officer separated them, recognized him as a cop so that they didn't handcuff him. Officer Garth Haynes was his name. They handcuffed the guys he was fighting with, and then as soon as those guys were handcuffed and laying on the ground, Haynes went over and stomped on the head of one of them. King County prosecutors looked at the dash cam videos and decided that a felony assault charge was not applicable, and so they decided to file charges of fourth-degree misdemeanor assault, which would mean if Haynes was convicted, he would face up to a year in jail or a $5,000 fine. That's if he's convicted, and that's if that sentence is imposed. Of course, predictably, the Seattle Police Union came out and said, oh, this is terrible that he was convicted of assault, even though you can clearly see on the dash cam video that you can find on the Seattle Times website, you can clearly see that it was assault and that he should have been charged with probably felony assault, not just misdemeanor, because when you stomp on somebody's head, that is pretty serious, I have to tell you.
All right. Moving on, state coming out with the final EIS on the tunnel?
Yeah, the state issued its final environmental impact statement on the tunnel. Now, it issued a draft environmental impact statement earlier this year, and the city reviewed it. And the city came back with their response. One of the responses involved a report called the Nelson-Nygaard report that talked about why the state's draft environmental impact statement was not complete on the downtown traffic tunnel, because it didn't take into account it didn't compare it with a surface alternative. Well, this environmental impact statement that the state has just released includes an appendix, Appendix 5, which talks about the Nelson-Nygaard report and attempts to remedy that problem that by saying, oh, yes, we have looked at a surface alternative. And what I'm finding from looking at it, I haven't had a chance to read the entire thing, but I've scanned it, and what I'm finding is that it really doesn't address the Nelson-Nygaard report, and it really doesn't talk about a surface alternative. It only pretty much brushes off the Nelson-Nygaard report by saying, and this is a direct quote, they basically say, this analysis concluded that while the surface transit I-5 concept may yield some benefits that are not associated with the tolled bored tunnel, it would substantially reduce north-south transportation capacity and would substantially increase travel times for north-south trips, particularly through trips. So what they're saying is that we concluded, we looked at the surface transit, we kind of did a quick scan of the surface transit I-5 concept, and even though it's got all these great benefits that you don't get when you build the tunnel, we still think it's going to increase your travel time trying to get north-south through the city. Okay, great. However, when you flip back a little bit further in Appendix 5, and they talk about increased delay and reduced reliability for critical transit services, they basically say that the surface transit and I-5 scenario would not increase travel times for transit versus the bored tunnel. So you have to look at that and you say, okay, wait. You're saying that transit through downtown Seattle, and as we know, most transit through downtown Seattle runs on a north-south route, that's not going to experience any delays if we have a surface alternative versus the bored tunnel. There's not going to be any delays there. But you're saying that auto traffic will have significant delays. I just don't see how that can be true. In my mind, that can't be true. So there's clearly, you know, that major contradiction in this environmental impact statement, that the excuse that they're giving for not studying the surface alternative really doesn't hold true, because they're contradicting themselves and saying, well, it's not going to delay transit. They're basically lying when they're saying that's the reason they're not studying the surface alternative. They're not studying the surface alternative because the state is fully committed to the Board Tunnel and they want to build that at all costs. And they're just using the traffic delays that they think the surface alternative might cause. They're using that as an excuse.
Let's move on to national and obesity rates here in the U.S.
Yeah, a report was released this week showing that all states in the United States have obesity rates over 20%, except for one state. That's the state of Colorado, with a 19.8% of adults considered obese. That, in comparison with the last time they did the study in 1995, the state with the lowest rate, Colorado, at 19.8%, is a higher rate than the highest rate of any state in 1995, and they're finding that most states doubled their obesity rates in that time. However, the report doesn't look at the reason for obesity rates in the United States, and I find that often the discussion is that, well, you know, people make poor food choices, you know, or they're marketed the wrong types of foods, people don't exercise enough. This comes, you know, at a time when exercise and nutrition is being promoted at record levels in the United States. I think what they're not talking about is the overall lack of nutrients in our food. Studies have shown that even vegetables grown nowadays have fewer nutrients than vegetables that were grown just 50 years ago, which means when your body is confronted with food that has less nutrients in it, you crave more food in order to get the nutrients that you need. You end up consuming more calories. In addition, a recent study that came out just a couple of weeks ago showed that study compared rates of exercise that people get on the job with increasing rates of obesity. And what they found is that there is a direct correlation between the amount of exercise you get at work, not the amount of exercise you get in your leisure time, but the amount of exercise you get at work on the job and rates of obesity in the United States. So as we become much more sedentary in the office, using our email, texting people, using our cell phones instead of getting up and walking down the hall to talk with colleagues or getting up and going upstairs to deliver a report, if we deliver it via email instead, we're really doing ourselves terrible damage to our health by increasing obesity rates, because we just don't get as much exercise at work as we used to just 20 years ago, or just 15 or 16 years ago during the time of the last report.
All right. So we just need to work people a lot harder at work.
No, you just need to stop relying on your email, stop sitting in front of the computer, put down that cell phone, get up and talk to people, and you'll find that you're getting a lot more exercise than you used to.
All right. Let's move on. Study out on the flash crash.
Yeah, just a study by the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. They were looking at the role of commodities markets in the flash crash that happened last year on May 6, 2010, when the stock market lost a huge amount of value in a very, very short period of time, and some stocks, major stocks on the stock market dropped to nearly zero, dropped to under a dollar in price, and then bounced back just in a matter of a few minutes. The flash crash, it turns out, we talked about this before, other studies have shown that the flash crash was probably exacerbated, if not caused, by the role of high-frequency traders. Traders who are companies that get into the market, they start out in the morning with owning no stock and no bonds, then they pour millions of dollars into the market by buying and selling and making a profit off of the few cents of profit that you can make when you time your buys and sells during the day, and then they end the day with owning no stocks or bonds. They are strictly basically speculating on the movement of prices in the stock market. Well, what the Commodity Futures Trading Commission is found out in their analysis of commodities markets during the flash crash is that 95% of all the trades on commodities markets during any given day are day traders or high-frequency traders. They're finding that about 5% of the trading on commodities markets are what you would call or what you would consider to be legitimate commodities traders, people who have to buy contracts in order to ensure the delivery of the actual commodity itself. All of the rest of the trades are people buying and selling oil futures the same day, pretty much the same day they bought them, in order to take advantage of little price swings, and that can contribute vastly to the run-up in oil prices, particularly when you see oil prices spike and drop within a matter of minutes of for example the tsunami and earthquake in Japan, when you saw the price of oil spike and drop and spike and drop and spike and drop. That's because of those day traders that make up 95% of the commodity markets.
Wow. All right. Moving on, rice farmers looking at...
Well, I'd like to talk for a minute about the jobs report. I think the jobs report is more important.
Yes.
This week, the national jobs report was released, and you know, there was all kind of speculation leading up to the release of the jobs report, saying, well, the June jobs report is going to be really good. We expect at least 90,000 jobs were created in June, and then economists revised that upward, saying, oh no, 120,000. Oh no, now we expect it to be 200,000 new jobs in June. You know, May was just a flash in the pan, because May we saw a really poor jobs report of only 50,000 jobs created in May. They said, oh no, that was just a little blip because of the earthquake and tsunami in Japan. Well, then the real report was issued on Friday, and it showed that June the economy added just 18,000 jobs, which was way under what the even initial estimates of the June jobs report were. That was a figure that was even worse than May, because the May numbers were also revised downward to half of what we thought we had gained in May. So only 25,000 jobs were added in May. And in addition, when you looked deeper into the numbers, you found that the only industries that increased jobs in June were healthcare services and the leisure and hospitality industry, meaning that healthcare, which will always increase jobs as long as we have an increase in population, particularly an aging population, they were seasonal, because the leisure and hospitality industry is basically tourism. So that's very grim news, and it's proving that the downturn is a real one. It's not just a blip in the recovery. It's actually a return of the recession. When they looked a little further at the May jobs report too, you see that hourly pay rates fell, that workers worked fewer hours, and that employment increased to 9.2%, because more people thought that, well, I have to get out there. I'm desperate. I have to get out there. I have to get some income in the door. So more people joined the ranks of folks hunting for jobs. And so you can ask, why is hiring so dismal? Well, on the national scene, you often see politicians and you see various media pundits say, well, it's because of the deficit. It's because of a lack of government spending. It's because of gas prices. It's because of the housing market. Well, no, it's because of consumer spending. People don't have the money to spend. Consumer spending drives 70% of the economy. And if consumers aren't buying stuff, corporations and companies can't sell stuff. They can't hire people. What we've seen in the last decade, because of the depredations of the housing market, we've seen a flood of money going up the income ladder, and we have seen no money trickling back down. And so what needs to happen, you know, you can talk all you want about cutting the deficit and talk all you want about government spending, but what needs to happen is a redistribution of wealth down the income ladder in some way. I don't know what the actuals of that should be, but if you look at any proposal to try to create jobs that doesn't involve redistribution of wealth, then you can pretty much guess that that's not going to work.
Talking with Maria Tomchik with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
You can find Eat the State on the web. Our internet address is www.eatthestate.org.